The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows. Hi, I'm Robert King, and you're listening to The Secrets of Movies and TV Shows, where we look beyond the surface to the deeper meanings and ideas in the shows and movies that we all love. This episode, we'll be talking about Casablanca, the classic 1942 film about people caught on the fringes of World War II, starring Humphrey Bogart, Ingrid Bergman, Claude Rains, and a cantina full of European refugees singing their hearts out. Joining me today are Noelle Heister-Crowe. Welcome, Noelle.
Hi. Thank you. It's good to be here.
And also joining me is Shelley Kelly. It's good to have you on the show, Shelley.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
All right. I know we're eager to get into it, but before we do, I want to thank those who make this show possible, our patrons on Patreon. Today, we'd especially like to thank Matthew D., Petru, Robert C., Alan P., and Ferdinand V. Your contributions allow us to record, edit, and distribute this show and the rest of the shows we make at StarQuest. If you listeners would like to join them in supporting our work, you can do so at sqpn.com/give. So now, it's 1941. Refugees from across Europe are fleeing the Nazis, trying to reach America, but the path to freedom runs through French Morocco on the northwest tip of Africa, through the city of Casablanca, where a delicate balance of powers means that many refugees are stuck in a political limbo. Rick Blaine runs a nightclub catering to expatriates and refugees. He caters to all but sticks his neck out for nobody. But then Ilse Lund, a Swedish refugee, walks into his gin joint and reminds him of his past, when he had been a gun runner for the French Resistance, and her lover, until she abandoned him with no explanation on the very moment of his escape from the German armies. Now she's traveling with Victor Laszlo, a Czech resistance leader whom she claims is her husband, and is trying to get him to America. But the Germans pressure the local government to keep him stuck in Casablanca. And this puts Rick in a unique position. See, he has signed letters of transit that will allow two people to leave Casablanca for Lisbon and thence America without question. But which two? Will he reclaim his love who broke his heart? Or will he support her husband whose message could stir up America against the Nazis? We know the answer, don't we? One of the greatest finishes in cinematic history. Ilse and Laszlo head off to America, and Rick rejoins the resistance against the Nazis in the beginning of a beautiful friendship. So let's talk about this amazing film. And let's start with the setting. It's iconic. It's almost otherworldly to us here in the 21st century, but it still strikes a deep chord. Shelley, let's start with you. What strikes you most about the whole setup to Casablanca?
I love how quickly they wrote and sold and filmed and released this movie. The inspiration for the film came from a three-act play that was, it was inspired by the author's visit to Vienna in 1938. And you have to remember that throughout all of this, in 1938, the United States was not yet in World War II. And when this movie was made, we had just entered into World War II, but the movie itself is set before the United States was in World War II. So you have to remember the context of this very short period of time. And no one knew when they made the movie how World War II was going to end.
Indeed.
All of that is very true. And it's really, yeah, it's really amazing that it's so iconic of the war, of certain attitudes about the war. It instills patriotism while at the same time it balances Americans' desire to not be part of the war in many different ways. And so it really is this really unique, sort of beautiful balancing act of values that they put into it in a delightful story that they do it so well.
Yeah, the drama of it, the melodrama even, doesn't compromise on any of the complexity of what's going on in Europe at that time and across the globe. And yeah, I like you say, I love the way it's patriotic without being nationalistic. It shows what we love and value about America through the eyes of Europe and Africa and all those from outside who are looking to America for help.
Right. The core message, I think, in the film, beyond the love story, is that you cannot remain neutral, that you must fight to save the world. It's not about this country or that country. It's about freedom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if we're jumping super far ahead, but the fact that there are so few Americans actually in the movie itself, it's a truly international cast of people who were affected by the events that had been happening outside of America at that time. So as you look at the stories of the people who were part of this movie, and one of my favorite characters is Asisa Call, and he was called Cuddles in Hollywood, and he has absolutely that personality, and that there's always the big joke of grabbing his cheek and shaking it because he's got that round face in so many of his movies. But he was a Jewish Hungarian refugee. He lost sisters in the concentration camps. And while he's this jovial personality, he has this backstory. So for me, he's one of my favorite characters in Casablanca just because of his story and the way that he came to Hollywood, and knowing that story just enriches it for me. But many of the other actors also have these similar refugee status, that they had come to Hollywood fleeing. Even the director, Michael Curtiz, had come earlier, and then his family, he had worked to get his family out. A number of the other ones were Jews from different theaters around Europe, Austria, Germany, France, even Rick's girlfriend.
Ilsa?
Girlfriend. Not Ilsa.
Yvonne at the beginning.
Yvonne, yeah. She and her husband were refugees from the French theater. So even though they didn't know, they didn't know about how the war would end, but these events that were happening before America got into the war that most Americans were not aware of, were not really aware of what was happening with the refugees, with the concentration camps, with these things. Most Americans really didn't have any idea. But all of these people involved in the film, they knew personally. And that really comes across.
Yeah,
that makes it really powerful. Mm-hmm. And so the author of the play is Murray Burnett. And his writing partner was Joan Allison. But Murray Burnett went with his wife to Antwerp and to visit some of her family.
And this is they in 1938?
1938.
Okay,
and they
yeah.
had heard about what was going on with the laws against the Jewish people, et cetera, but they hadn't seen it firsthand. And her family asked if they could go, because they were Americans, could go into Vienna and help some other family members retrieve money and valuables, because people were trying not just to get out, but they couldn't bring anything with them
right.
on this trail. And so they went over there. When they went to the consulate first to get a visa, and the consulate told them, I don't recommend you go at all, but if you go, you must absolutely wear this American flag pin on your lapel. Hmm. And if anything happens to you while you're there, the consulate, the United States, cannot help you at all. You're 100% on your own. So
wow.
they went, they experienced this and realized that what they had heard back in the States was nothing what was really happening. Mm-hmm. And they were able to smuggle out a lot of materials for the families. And then they escaped back out of this Nazi-occupied territory. And they were going into a jazz club in the south of France, somewhere near Monte Carlo, I think. And he walked into this smoky jazz club with an African-American piano player crooning tunes that were reminiscent of his college days. And he looked around and said, this is the perfect setting for a play. And that's where the idea of Everybody Comes to Rick's was born.
Has that play ever been producer developed apart from the movie Casablanca, or did it just morph into Casablanca and that's the flower that came from its bud?
Yeah. They wrote the play and they tried to sell it in the theater area, but they weren't getting a lot of high dollar offers. Mm. And so they decided to shop it to Hollywood, and it landed on Warner Brothers' desk within days of Pearl Harbor. And they purchased it and developed it.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And at the time, Hal Wallace, who was their producer, he was a tremendous producer, and there was a deal at Warner Brothers that he would get top pick of anything that came by. So it was presented to him, and he decided to go with it. And apparently he was good friends with Michael Curtiz, and the two families had gone together on vacation right around the same time. So they started collaborating together to put together the film, which needed to go through a lot of revisions to go from a play to a screenplay. And so a lot of the iconic lines and things came from the twins who wrote it. Actually, I think that's really cool. The Epstein twins.
Yeah, the Epsteins, yeah. I heard that they were working on the script even as they were shooting it. Like they were, actors were getting fresh pages pretty much every day. And
Casablanca was one of those rare movies that was actually shot in sequence because of that fact that they didn't actually have the entire script. And so normally a movie, they'll shoot around an actor's schedule or something. And so a lot of the scenes will be out of order as they're just doing this and that, of that kind of, or all the scenes that go in this one location, we'll just do all those scenes and you don't really do it in order. But because they didn't have the full script and they didn't even have the ending, I think they'd shot almost all of the movie before they even got to what we know now is that just classic ending. Mm. They did it, they shot it in order, which is crazy to think about.
That's almost unheard of. Yeah.
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 And it was all on set except for a scene at the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was all studio sets, which I guess gives you a lot of control over. You can shoot it in sequence because you've got your set there and it's not going anywhere. But yeah.
And the Epstein brothers were known for their witty, cheeky humor. And so they crafted a lot of those iconic lines that we know today. Then they had another writer brought in to do more of the melodrama. And then they had an uncredited writer, Casey Robinson. They brought him in to focus on the love scenes, which had to pass the censors of the day, the moral censors of the day.
Yeah, because this was under the Hollywood code. Yeah.
So quite frankly, I think it's a better movie for that. I think it would be so much cheaper because I know the original script, you know, was much more explicit about the sexual relationship with Rick and Ilsa. Mm-hmm. She wasn't named Ilsa, she was named Lois, but between the two characters. Whereas taking that, moving that back a little bit, making it maybe implied, maybe not. I think it adds not only for me as a Catholic in terms of watching it morality wise, and I feel like I can enter more into this romantic relationship, but even still, it's just, it adds to the romanticism of it that it's not really clear how much or where that whole part of it. I think it just makes it more mysterious and more romantic. Well, so
and it adds to the drama of the tension between Rick and Laszlo, who mm-hmm. are competing for Ilsa's affections. And it lets you know that what matters isn't, oh, who did what or how far did they go or anything like that. But what matters is, where do your loyalties lie? Where does your love lie? What is it that you most truly value? And what is it that you want for each other? What is it that you want for Ilsa in the moment? What is it you want for yourself? And what is it that you want for the whole world around you? So yeah, by right. keeping it a little more abstract, it allows the focus to remain on the moral question itself rather than the, but you did what with my wife, and turning into like a, I don't know, an almost petty outrage.
Well, you were talking earlier about the today's settings versus the settings of the time frame of the movie. You can even talk about that in terms of our modern outlook on what love is and the whole idea that In a modern film, if you're in love with somebody, there's no question that you're going to like immediately jump into bed with them, versus that there are even bigger questions than love. There, you're talking about morality and your values. There are things that are more valuable than just your love with you two people together. And those things should be brought into the equation of your relationship, right? And so in this case, it's not this, there, I think the movie sort of toys with the question of whether there's going to be, in a sense, the sterility of a self-focused relationship, or if there's something, or if they're going to turn to something bigger, which ultimately happens and is much more satisfying as an ending.
I think movies today could take their cue from the movies of the past and put a little more, did they or didn't they, or keep it at that level, because it creates drama and it makes you say, what do you think happened?
Mm-hmm.
And if for some reason an explicit scene in some way or an explicit reference needs to happen, it's that much more powerful because it comes in the context of we normally don't or hear about. Yeah, it's important to understand that the things that we keep private are kept private for a reason, and that it needs an exceptional reason for it to come forward.
And something else that you were talking about, how they filmed this in sequence. And we've mentioned that the writing wasn't even complete. No one quite knew what the ending was. Mm-hmm. Humphrey Bogart playing Rick. And is it Paul playing?
Henried.
Yeah, Paul Henried.
Paul Henried.
Thank you. And he's playing Victor Laszlo. The two men, if they don't know exactly who's going to get the girl in the end or how it's going to work out, it creates that tension when they're standing there facing each other. And is there something you need to tell me? And back and forth. So clearly they're wanting, each of them wants to get the girl. And that comes across on the camera too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because of the code, I think they knew that Ilsa wouldn't leave him for Rick.
Right.
But there are a lot of other possibilities that could happen in the middle of that. Yeah.
I think the ending that they had for a long time was that Rick was going to be arrested and walked off. And that's not a very satisfying ending after all of the tension and all of the sort of building that's happening as you get towards the end. So came up with a brilliant solution.
Yeah. Yeah. One that's both a happy ending and a tragic ending at the same time. Talking about the sort of self-centeredness and selfish focus shifting to a more caring and loving focus, there's a contrast between a couple scenes that are just fantastic. And one of them, of course, is the speech at the end, you know, the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans, and the insight that Rick is showing. But it's that much more powerful because it contrasts with a scene that I love, but I don't think is quoted nearly enough. It's right at the beginning. Rick is coming into the bar and his girlfriend of the moment, Yvonne, is there. Rick is checking the receipts at the bar and Yvonne says to him, "Where were you last night?" And he says, "That's so long ago, I can't remember." And she says, "Will I see you tonight?" He says, "I never make plans that far in advance." And that just encapsulates how sort of closed off and self-contained Rick is trying to make his entire life. And I think the contrast between that and the openness to life, to possibility, to even to, you know, his own death, ultimately. I mean, that captures the moral arc of the film for me.
No, we see throughout the film why he's like that, because he has loved and lost. And so he closes himself off so he can never be hurt again. I stick my neck out for nobody. Like you were saying about, I don't make plans. I'm neutral. Nothing's going to touch me. I'm here. I'm not even that great of a businessman, but we do okay. Right? He doesn't take a stand on any one particular thing until Laszlo and Ilsa walk back through that door. And suddenly he has this whole, it's like ripping open a wound and he completely changes. It's like he wouldn't allow himself to feel any emotion after what happened. But now it's that transformation is starting to happen again.
And you see that contrast again with how the Sydney Greenstreet character, whose name I'm forgetting at
the Ferrari.
Name, Ferrari. How Ferrari stays very much, it's all business. Everything's business. It's all business. But for Rick, it can't just be all business anymore. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Suddenly he's breaking precedent. He's sitting down and having a drink with a customer. He's saving a young girl's virtue. Mm-hmm. That scene is so powerful when you watch it and you realize what's going on with the police, Louis Renault, Captain Renault, mm-hmm. that he's implied that he's a womanizer and he will strongly give favors implied. Or other yes. favors that they never show it. And so when that girl approaches him and says, is he a man of his word? If I do this, will he give me the exit visa? And Rick's, yeah, he is. But then his own situation is so much in focus. It's in his head that he goes and does something he's never done before. Even his floor managers, how are we doing today? Several thousand less than I, thanks to you. But his staff, if you look at how Carl responds to him, how yes. Sasha, the bartender, responds to him, they realize what has happened, that he is softening, that he's opening and being more humane. He's looking with caring on his fellow humans.
And you get that sense that they're both glad for him and afraid for him, because being human in Casablanca is very dangerous.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Did y'all happen to notice how he had a name change in the film?
Rick did?
Mm-hmm. So when they do the flashback to his time with Elsa in Paris, mm-hmm. how he's in Paris, we know that he's run guns in Ethiopia. We know that he can't go back to the United States. He fought against the fascists. He's called Richard. If you look at mm-hmm. it, Sam calls him Richard. And Ilsa never says mm-hmm. his name, but when she gives him the letter that says, I can't go with you, she writes Richard. Mm-hmm. And then when she comes in, she recognizes Sam, but she's, who's Rick? Mm. He changes his name when she breaks his heart and he becomes a different person. But at the end, she calls him Richard again.
He's different. People call him lots of different names throughout. But I think that Rick Richard is maybe the most significant. Yeah. He goes from Richard, which is like it's a full rich name, and he shortens it to Rick, which is short and hard, and just the sound of it is very stopped there. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And even Sam does it. Sam, he calls him Richard when they're in Paris, and then when they're at Rick's place,
he calls boss him Rick. Mostly, isn't it?
Boss, yeah.
Boss, but yeah.
Right. Speaking of Sam... on a different subject.
Yes.
It is so hard to imagine Casablanca without, as time goes by, right? It's woven throughout in the score. Of course, you have, that's the song that ties the whole romance together, going back in the flashback to Paris, and then Ilsa walking in, asking Sam to play it, and Rick getting upset and eventually asking Sam to play it again. And yet the music director of the film didn't like that song. It was put in there by the original playwrights. It was a song that Burnett had heard when he was in college, and a musical that he had heard in college and had incorporated into the screenplay. And they kept it in with all the writing. They kept that in. But the music director didn't like it and wanted to actually do his own score. And the only reason why it stayed in was because Ingrid Bergman had left even before the ending, they finished filming everything, or the completion of the movie, to go to film While the Bell Tolls. When the Bell Tolls? For Whom the Bell Tolls. There we go. I'm like, wait, that's not right at the beginning. But she had gone to film that, and her character in that had very short hair, and
right,
she had
right.
to have her hair cut for it. So they couldn't actually have her come back and film because the
drastic change
and to change it. And so the song got saved. thankfully.
By Ingrid Bergman's haircut.
By Ingrid Bergman's haircut. Because really, you just cannot imagine Casablanca without that song. It just has this wonderful, haunting quality to it. It works beautifully for the romantic part, but it also, I think, underscores that air of sort of mystery and otherness that is Casablanca. So anyways, I thought that was just, I was like, thank goodness for that haircut.
Yeah.
And it ties it in for me with, I think it's Sleepless in Seattle. They play that song and the Tom Hanks character says, "Here's looking at you, kid." And I love how classic this movie is, that it goes out and touches other films and other, it just pulls mm-hmm. forward into our daily lexicon.
So many different things. And did you know, "Hey, here's looking at you, kid," that line was not in the script?
No, I didn't.
I heard they took it from a side comment that Bogart made.
To Bergman, yeah. That's something he would say to her, apparently off camera, like when they were resting between takes or something, and then they included it into the film.
Yeah.
It's just fun, like how all these lines that you hear now, they're part of our culture and mm-hmm. that people say, and they come from these different little places.
And they get twisted too, because if you think about it, we would say, "Play it again, Sam," right? And that's not said, it's "Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by. If you can play it for her, you can play it for me. She can make it. I can too."
Exactly. They never say it. But what I always hear that when I say, "Play it again, Sam." Was it? Is it in like Murder by Death or something? Do you know that movie?
Oh, it's a long time since I've seen it, but it's brilliant. Yeah.
Yeah. When did they have all the spoofs of the detectives? And what is his name? Anyways, the guy who's playing the spoof. Is it Peter Falk also playing it? But he's playing the spoof on Sam Spade. And so the girl who's with him's like, "Play it again, Sam," or whatever, in that movie. Anyways, sorry, funny little aside.
No, but there's a lot about this movie that has just become like part of the foundation of modern American culture, at least. And I don't know how far it's spread beyond America, maybe as far as the dark depths of Canada even. But yeah, it's just foundational. There are some parts of it that maybe haven't aged quite so well. I think all of us would have liked to see Sam's character fleshed out a little more and more. Yeah, the diversity of Europeans was well shown, but the diversity of refugees in general was maybe not represented as well as it could have been.
But that they did for the time period was outstanding.
Yeah.
It was the first time that they'd ever had an African-American performer be treated, not so much that he was treated as an equal, but treated sympathetically, to be given prominence in a film.
He was Rick's employee, but he wasn't Rick's servant.
But he wasn't, was he an employee when they were in Paris? And that's what I wasn't clear on, because he is shown as a loyal friend first. And yes, he works for him. And yes, but if you think about it, they treat each other with respect, appropriate to the time period, yes, which we're looking at with 21st century eyes and all of that we have evolved and grown. They speak to each other with, how do I phrase this? Humphrey Bogart is never derogatory at all towards Sam. And Sam has a major role in this. Without Sam, there is no Ricks. And Sam was the first character written into the play as part of the... He was the original part of the setting. And the casting director wanted to make that character a female and actually looked at Lena Horne or Ella Fitzgerald for the role. But in the end, they cast. Yep. But in the end, they cast Wilson. Arthur Wilson. Yeah. Dooley
Wilson. Yeah.
Who got the nickname Dooley Wilson for portraying an Irishman in whiteface.
Really?
Yes. Crazy, right?
Was this on stage or on screen? I can see this in a vaudeville show or something,
Yeah.
Yes, he was a vaudeville performer.
Wow.
And he was a real singer, but he played he dressed up as a leprechaun and sang Mr. Dooley with a thick Irish brogue. And he did all of that number in whiteface.
Oh, wow.
Vaudeville is very different.
Vaudeville is very different. Yeah. Yeah.
Very,
that would
very.
Not go over at all today.
But I couldn't imagine it without him. And they wanted to dub his singing too, but in the end they did leave it. But he did not play the piano. So all the time you see his hands moving, and those of us that play, we knew that. But they
it's very rare for people to actually be playing the piano on screen.
Yeah, yeah. He was actually a drummer.
His voice has such a wonderful timbre and richness to it. I can't imagine all of those songs without him there.
Yeah. I always wonder what happened to him after Rick sold him along with the cafe.
25% of the profits.
Yeah.
He got a raise.
He did get that, right. But, you know.
Because his friend took care of him. If he knew he was going to either go to jail or get sent away, he had to make sure his people were taken care of before he left. Mm-hmm. His employees, his friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, that way. But I also but you're right. Rick, he was with Rick in Paris. He was with Rick in Casablanca. He was with Rick a lot. So it just in terms of now losing that part of his life, suddenly, yes, getting 25%, but also working for somebody else, having that different relationship. How did
but
that
ultimately
end up?
The movie wasn't about Sam. So.
No, I know. I just always wonder how did that end up? Did he find Rick eventually later? I imagine that they did.
If they were going off, if he and Captain Renault were going off and having this beautiful friendship and what was it, a free French garrison somewhere else, I'd like to imagine that he made arrangements to bring his friend Sam out of Casablanca and have him so that they could open up another bar.
They're not going to that free French garrison to open a bar, though. They are going to start fighting in the war.
Fighting.
And I always figured that Rick was going off essentially to die, that he and Renault were going to fight the good fight and go down opposing the Nazis. And maybe that's just because I love a tragedy. I love that sort of the idea of a noble death, but that's always how I imagined Rick.
It's funny, I never imagined that. Maybe it's a male-female difference.
I don't imagine going
off to war to die, but I see it as he could work behind the scenes and collect and feed information by running the nightclub.
There are
lots of different
This is the great thing is the film leaves it completely open-ended. They're literally walking off into the mist and becoming more and more vague as that last shot progresses.
It really is the perfect ending.
It's fantastic.
Round up the usual suspects.
Round up the usual suspects. Let's talk about Renault. Talk about a really interesting character transition. We don't see the sort of progression of it as much as we see in Rick, because the movie is about Rick. It's Rick's movie. But I just love the sort of subtle hints you get that Renault is thinking about and then eventually following in Rick's footsteps.
There's no doubt he's a scoundrel, right?
Oh, yeah.
The scene in the beginning where the young Bulgarian girl is trying to figure out how to get the passage for herself and her husband and might be what she might have to give in order to get those from Renault. And the great scene where he has to shut down Rick's gambling. I'm shocked to find there's gambling here. And so you can see that he doesn't have his heart entirely in his job, but he's definitely looking out for himself. And he's playing both sides as you go along. So you have those hints that he could go either way, but somehow because he delivers some of the best lines of the movie, you just know he's not going to and end up being completely villainous.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives us a clue that he also will not remain neutral. That self-preservation and remaining neutral, it's a theme that's running.
Yes. There's
all this overlapping business here. But no one can remain neutral in this conflict. And at the very end, if you watch, he's pouring himself a glass of water and he looks at the bottle and the bottle says Vichy water.
Yes.
And Vichy is the Nazi controlled independent France, air quotes, independent France. He drops it in the trash. And so that's that answer to the question that Rick asks him, are you free France or Vichy? And he's basically saying, nope, I've chosen a side. No longer do I walk this tightrope in the middle.
Yeah, that's a great, just the image.
And people who went to the movie theaters in 1942 and 43, they would have recognized the symbolism of dropping that bottle into the trash. Mm-hmm. Whereas today, we may not know what Vichy water is or what that phrase means.
Not unless we know some of the history of early World War II and the French Resistance. Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
For sure. I love classic movies, so, and I love Casablanca. And one of my things is just, I've seen a lot of these actors in different movies as well. I don't know if you've watched as many as I have, but fun because you recognize the core, right? So Humphrey Bogart and Sidney Greenstreet and Peter Lorre are all together. And I believe it was right before this in The Maltese Falcon, which is also another just classic film noir. So well done. And with Mary Astor there. And the person who originally read the screenplay, then when it was purchased by Warner Brothers, actually suggested that Humphrey Bogart and Mary Astor would be perfect for those lead roles in the play that he read. Of course, when Wallace read it, he immediately went to Ingrid Bergman, who they had to get from a different studio. But definitely, I think the right casting with this international crew that you have, to have had Mary Astor, I think would have, yeah, definitely would have changed the tone in a lot of ways from the couple who are already fighting the Nazis in Europe while Americans are not involved. That would change a lot. But anyways, that's neat. But my favorite trivia question, if you've actually watched lots of movies, like I have lots of movies from this era. So S.C. Sakal, who I mentioned before, one of my favorite character actors, and Sidney Greenstreet actually were together in another movie. Do you know which one I could see?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Christmas in Connecticut.
Christmas in Connecticut, yeah.
Our favorite Christmas movie. We watch it. My young adult daughters and I, we watch it every year together.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's such a different movie from this one, but it's always like really fun. Which two movies were both of these actors in together?
What's funny is I think I recognized them both from Christmas in Connecticut before I remembered that Sidney Greenstreet was in Casablanca.
What's great is...
So there's your like party trivia for the next time you're...
But I love how Casablanca takes them and a little bit plays them against type. Humphrey Bogart is absolutely Humphrey Bogart, and he's one of those stars who always plays himself. But Sidney Greenstreet is definitely, he's not a hero, but he's not villainous in this, in the way he is in The Maltese Falcon. And
right.
Claude Rains, again, playing a really complex character rather than, I'm used to him playing more caricatured characters, and especially Peter Lorre, again, playing more desperate than villainous.
Claude Rains, we know from Capra, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. He plays the senator.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Takes the young Jimmy Stewart under his wing and then betrays him and then confesses everything. So. And was Peter Lorre, was he in Arsenic and Old Lace? Am I thinking of the right?
I believe so, yeah.
Yes, he was, yeah.
And that's the first place I saw him.
He's the assistant to Jonathan.
Yes,
Mr. Jonathan. Oh, that's what a great film that is.
Yes. So many great ones from that time.
We'll need another lock for the canal. Oh, man.
So, fun thing in my high school was called Trivium School, and each year we had to be in a play. We rotated our arts, if you will, through music, art, drawing, and drama every year in our trimesters. And so when I was in 10th grade, we did Arsenic and Old Lace. I was Aunt Abby.
Excellent.
Yes. One of my favorite roles that I got to play when I was in high school.
So this is one of the the studio system had lots of issues and problems and so on, but it did create this sort of repertory cast that, yeah, that played a huge variety of roles. And some of them got very typecast and some of them were able to break out of that.
But. And a lot of these refugees were theater actors and film actors already in their own countries, in their own languages. And so bringing them, they've already escaped and they're given a job. Mm-hmm. And I love the idea that they, that Warner Brothers especially was so sympathetic to the cause and to the war and what was going on that they mm-hmm. hired so many of them. And
Even Conrad Veidt, who played Major Strasser, was a Jewish refugee from Germany with his wife coming over. So even though he was playing the villain, the German Nazi villain, he was actually a refugee from that itself. So exactly.
I think it's very hard for us to sometimes put ourselves in that moment because we know the ending. We know what happened and we know everything that we look at it from hindsight and we look at it with a lot of distance. There's no personal emotional ties anymore to our generation. Say, we're talking 80 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know what it was really like, the uncertainty of it all, the fear, the bravery, the trying to save yourself or trying to do the right thing. I can't even imagine because we already know what's going to happen. And so it's hard to go back. I want to make sure we talk about the scene in the movie where they play the Free France National Anthem.
Oh, yes.
What that meant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes. What that meant to the actors themselves to film that scene.
Yeah. This is such an emotional scene there. And yeah, part where you see like Yvonne singing and she's just so emotional and just everything. And that's because so many of the actors were personally involved in fleeing this horror that was happening over in Europe. Such an amazing scene.
Such a beautiful, inspired act of saying, we will not be defeated. We are going to stand and fight. And it gives me chills every time I see it when the Germans are doing their German singing and Laszlo has just come out and he said, I'm the leader of a great movement. And he goes and he stands in front of the band and their heads are down. They're like not looking at the Germans. And a lot of people on that side of the room are down. And he says, play La Marseillaise. Say it again because I don't say, I can't
say
French.
Play La Marseillaise. Yeah.
Yes.
La Marseillaise. Thank you.
Play La Marseillaise. Yeah.
Band leader looks at Rick.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And Rick gives the nod. So even this great inspirational leader of the resistance of the underground is getting permission from Rick. Rick has to make a decision mm-hmm. and he allows it.
Yeah. And it's the first time he challenges Renaud, are you Vichy or Free French? Here's the same question posed to Rick and he has to make a choice. And this might be that first moment of really, I think we can call it conversion or reversion maybe in Rick. Is being challenged by Laszlo and stepping up to that challenge. Yes, we will step out despite the fear, despite the threat that the German soldiers in the bar, he doesn't know what they're going to do. And there are lots of German soldiers in the city. They could shut him down, and they in fact do.
They don't. Renaud has to do it. They tell Renaud to do it.
And I don't know. It brings me back to, I think this is the notion of faith, ultimately, when it comes right down to it, whether it's a religious faith or another kind of faith. Faith is putting your trust in something even when you're afraid of it. There's that element of courage in faith. And Rick begins to trust in humanity again in that moment. And Laszlo is that beacon that calls on others to put their trust forth, despite their fear. I'm reminded of the passage from 1 John where it says, there is no fear in love. And we're talking about that love that is charity, that is caring for other people. But perfect love casts out fear. And I think that's what we see over the course of this movie. In all of the characters, everyone is bound by fear at the beginning, right? But through a variety of different kinds of love, they begin to cast off that fear and step forward into freedom. I don't know. For me, that's what is hugely inspiring about the movie. And I think one of the reasons I have loved it so much since the first time I saw it. Yeah.
And my children have all loved this movie. Even my son, and he's 12. I can't remember how old he was the first time he came in the room while I was watching it and watched it with me. But if I'm watching it, he wants to come in and sit and watch this movie with me. And so it's timeless. And yet it represents and showcases such a beautiful moment when the world came together.
Yeah. Can I ask us to just maybe put together one last thought to sum up what you love about Casablanca? Something that maybe we haven't mentioned yet, or something that we have that you really want to like hammer home at the end.
I love that when Rick and Ilsa are together and she says, I love you and I choose you over Laszlo. But I want to go and I want to escape with you. You don't know if she's being truthful or if she's being serious. But what we do know is that Rick loves her. He loves her more than anything because of what we've talked about earlier. And when he says, I'll go with you, and then flips it, I remember thinking two things. One is, if you love something, you have to set it free. Mm-hmm. And so he loves her so much, he releases her. And he gives her to her husband. And he recognized that for her husband to be able to do the good in the world and lead the underground movement, he must have his wife at his side, because he loves her too. And she inspires him. She gives him motivation to continue fighting. And I just love that notion that Rick goes there from being bitter and hard to sacrificial love.
Yeah. Noelle, how about you?
Oh, goodness. It's so hard to. But one of the things I really love about Casablanca is that it has, like we talked about at the beginning, it has this overarching set of values that it's presenting, but it doesn't present them in a way that's super in your face or that make light of the fact that these things are complicated and they're hard, and the choices that we make have multiple different paths that we could go on to make those choices. And as much as we like to, or at least I know I do, like to make everything sort of very black and white, it's never that black and white. And even though I think we all agree that ultimately Rick made the best choice possible, getting there wasn't easy. It wasn't clear. And if he had made a different choice, I don't know that we could have said it was necessarily the wrong choice that he made at that, you know, for that either. And I think that's one of the reasons why this is such an endearing movie and it's such a classic, is because it doesn't trifle with these difficulties. As well as just bringing all the emotion from all of the, as we've talked about, that international cast and all of the refugees and everything, that it just encapsulated it all so well. It's really amazing that they were able to capture all of that in this, you know, short period of time, really.
So much greatness in really a short little film, barely over 100 minutes. And yet it captures so much of humanity, so much of what it is to be moral, so much of what it is to love. Yeah. This has been an amazing discussion. Thank you both. For those of you out there listening, have you seen Casablanca? What do you think? We'd love to hear your thoughts as well. You can drop us a line at secrets@sqpn.com or join the conversation on Facebook. We're at StarQuest Media. We have a really active Discord server. That's my favorite place. So you can access it through sqpn.com/Discord. Once again, we'd like to thank our Patreon patrons. If you would like to join them in keeping our work going, visit sqpn.com/give. It also helps us when you subscribe to us or leave a review on your favorite podcast platform. We're on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, lots of others. We even have an SQPN YouTube channel. So check us out. That is all for now. Until next time, Shelley, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, you're welcome. I love being here.
Noelle, it's been great to have you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, wonderful.
Right on. Once again, I'm Robert King. Thank you for sharing the secrets of movies and TV shows on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy, The Secrets of Star Trek. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at sqpn.com/StarTrek. We'd like to thank Patrick McCaffrey of Moonshadow Studios for editing this episode. To have your audio edited professionally and with care, check out more of Patrick's work at moonshadowstudios.biz. That's moonshadowstudios.biz.